everybody. It's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
We're going to be looking into one of the most overlooked and emotionally complicated layers of the Brian Koberger case, his family. And this is not a piece to expose his family or cause, you know, tout blame on his family. I don't think they have anything to do with this whatsoever. I think they are very much victims in this as well. The people who just days before the world knew his name, they were sharing holiday meals with him. The same people who may now be walking into a courtroom, not just to sit behind him in support, but to testify against him. Not out of malice, but because they might have seen and heard things no one else did. Now imagine being a parent or sibling in that position. One minute you're watching Wheel of Fortune with your kid, the next you're on a subpoena list. That's not exactly the Christmas vibe anyone's going for. Joining us is someone who knows exactly what it means to analyze behavior when emotions are running high, retired FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, Robin Dreek. Robin, when you hear that prosecutors may be calling Koberger's own father or sister to testify, what immediately jumps out to you as a behavioral expert? And how does a situation like this, where familial loyalty crashes into legal obligation, tend to play out inside a house room or more or less a courtroom?
Sensitive, soft touch, which is always going to be key and critical, because here's a father and siblings and family members that, you know, it's hard to get over. This is your son. This is your brother. This is your baby boy. I mean, I always use that term thinking of my own kids.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the best way. So here, if I was doing this, and I think what they're going to do here as well, is they're not going to ask an opinion of him. They're not going to go down that road of subjective observation. I think they're going to most likely stick with observations of life arcs, behaviors. Mm-hmm. You know, tell me about what it was like with Brian growing up. What kind of things was he into? What was Brian's daily routine for this period of time, through this period of time, during this period of time? Did you see a deviation in that period of time when he came home on vacations? You know, when he first was a freshman in college, what was his routine like when he would come home for a holiday? So they're going to establish a baseline, at least not what I would think of his life arc for visits, for college, for school, for the way he lived life. And then they're going to then focus in on different a period of time during the murders. What was the behavior like then? What did you observe? What did he do? What they're most likely going to do is they're going to try to highlight a spike in behavior in that period of time, and not ask their conjecture on what they thought happened, because again, it's that would be too traumatic. I think they're going to then lay out their own thing for the jury to make their own decision. So I would use family members for establishing baselines of behavior, and then highlighting deviations from those baselines is what I would do to try to take the emotional part out. And also because they don't want to be seen as villains in this either by mm-hmm. anyone who's sympathetic to a son or a daughter, because that's exactly what defense is going to do, is try to paint him as a victim of the prosecution, a victim of society and all these things.
Yeah. Yeah. The fact that we have some history that we know about, one of the sisters, likely back, you know, before all this went down, he stole her cell phone. And this was apparently back when he was into heroin, needing money for drugs, allegedly. That's how the story goes. And his family turned him in. And I found that to be really interesting. What, I mean, that doesn't seem like it would be the first strike. If you stole your sister's phone, let's turn you into the police. I would think, you know, initially a lot of families would be like, whoa, 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 we can't be doing this. I'm going to guess that was probably not the first strike that something like this occurred, where you're going to go that far with your own son and a sister, you know, having a scuffle of, you know, I stole your phone, that sort of thing. Granted, they were, you know, adults or nearly adults at the time. What are your thoughts?
So, no, I've read Howard Bloom's book. Mm-hmm. on the Koberger case, on Koberger, the family, from the great interviews he did. And when they turned him in, the sense I get, and again, when you look at the amount of involvement, when you see a dad driving with his son cross country for Christmas break or Thanksgiving break when he's driving back with him, you know, my sense I get is that these things, and even turn him in for the drugs back then, it wasn't an act of malice or an act of resentment towards Brian. It was an act of love and compassion to try to save him.
Yeah.
You know, for, you know, here, let's help him to his bottom faster so he can actually have an aha moment, hopefully, and start his own recovery. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's what this family that has reps in is going above and beyond at wit's end of trying to figure out ways to help their son. And so I think that was an act of compassion. And so I think turning him in for drug addiction or drug use is going to be a lot different than saying, yes, I agree, he committed this murder.
Sure.
Because it's a different mindset that was at play there.
The fact that over the holiday break, when he went back to Pennsylvania for Thanksgiving and Christmas break, and everybody is looking for this white Elantra at the time. The public did not know the name Brian Koberger. People are just, what's going on here? His sister at home allegedly then was vocal enough to say, he has a white Elantra. However, she described his behavior, or the family kind of knows his behavior, as being kind of out there, kind of off, and saying, could it be him? That they actually go and look in his car. Again, that's kind of a strong one. I mean, it's one thing to be joking, hey, you got a white Elantra, you know, are they coming after you, bro? I mean, it wasn't like that. It was like, let's go look at his car, thinking, oh God, maybe he might be it. Like, that's a pretty swift conclusion to come to and think you might actually be right. I mean, it's coming in with some force. Again, another one of those moments where this family seemed to have, you know, just that dark feeling that, oh God, like he may have the potential to have done this. That's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, they've been victims, especially the sister, of his lifetime of behavior. And so when it gave her the ability to be, I think, more objective, you know, she's close enough as a family member, with an enhanced objectivity, because you've been a victim of him before in the past, it gave her the ability to do that. And, you know, to an extent, you know, the father as well, although you don't want to admit it, you know, it's him. He doesn't want to admit it, most likely.
Yeah.
Again, conjecture in my point, but, you know, just watching behaviors and being a father myself, you put yourself in that shoes, you know, and you're seeing it. And you're trying to be objective. You don't want to believe what you're seeing, but the sister, being, I think, a sibling rather than a parent, gives her that objectivity. Especially, she has been the victim of him in the past. The family's been a victim of him in the past, of these abhorrent behaviors. They've seen it. They've seen that life arc of him. They've experienced it their entire lives. And so, from their own point of view, especially the sisters, this wasn't a massive deviation from the arc she saw. And that's why she went to look at that car. Again, maybe not consciously thinking that, but it fit a pattern of behavior.
What sort of things do you think that they would be looking for in court if they call them as witnesses to testify? Let's start with the sister on that area.
I think they're going to go right on her observations. I think she's got, it wasn't intuition is the ability to our subconscious mind of seeing patterns of behavior. And when something deviates from a pattern of behavior, we take notice of it. And I think that's what they're going to really focus on with her, is what patterns of behavior, what things did you observe him doing that were not normal for him that you saw in the past, or were escalations over time? And so I think that's what they're going to really do, is because she paid attention. And so she paid so much attention to what she was seeing from him and then seeing in the media that she saw, we're going to take a look. And so I think that's what they're going to really zero in on, what her actual observations were.
Yeah, I mean, especially with him walking around the house with the latex gloves on. Do you think there was a level of comfort there that with Koberger, that he felt like, I'm in a safe place, like no one's going to go after me? I mean, it seems really ignorant, but again, he seems to miss a lot of social cues in general of what people are going to pick up on, while being very well versed in some other areas. He seems to think that his family you know, they're none the wiser. Is that a flaw on Koberger's part to yeah. have that assumption going on? And I guess why would he have it?
So really, really interesting thought there you have, Tony. And that is, so he was a student of forensic science. He's a student of investigations and crime, but he's not necessarily a great student of human behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wasn't really picking up on his own behavior and what that was looking like to someone else. In other words, because he lacked empathy, because if he's truly psychopathic in any way, again, not a licensed clinician, but lacking massive empathy, that means he has a lack of ability to see what he's perceived like and his behaviors from the world around him. And so with that lack of empathy, lack of ability to see what he looks like with his behavior, he's going to have lack of ability or thoughtfulness to see what his behavior at home looks like. And also because he's probably got his own life reps of behaving a little odd at home, having the shields down of who he is down and just being present in who he is and comfortable with it. He thought nothing of just being himself at home. And since this is a new thing he needs to do, I don't even think he thought about it. He just acted without actually understanding what the impact would look like to someone else.
Just like, I have to do this. It doesn't matter. They're not going to care. They're not going to notice. And just right over his head.
You gave that more thought than I think he did.
Yeah, probably just, did. Probably did.
I think he was just literally, he says, I have to do this. So I'm going to do this. And he's just, I studied it. I got to make sure I don't have my fingerprints on anything. Mm-hmm. Committed this crime. I got to, for a period of time, Manta, I think he's working in blocks of time that he thought were going to be appropriate. Mm-hmm. That's why he didn't turn his cell phone off from the time he thought of committing a murder. Like a year maybe prior to actually committing it, if he was doing it from that, if he was actually really, really thinking deeply,
mm-hmm.
again, let's assume it's him and yeah. he's not convicted yet, obviously. But if he, from the single point that he said, I need to do this to feel some rush. This is what my plan is. From that point on is when he should actually start turning his cell phone off when he goes out for a drive rather than in a time block, like the night of it. Because yeah. now it's too obvious. He has to, in order to hide in plain sight, you actually have to create plain sight, normal behavior over a large period of time. That was what is now granted. I feel like I'm giving instructions on every serial killer out there, but you got to establish periods of time. I only do this because literally,
yeah.
when we're recruiting a spy, how does a spy hide in plain sight? They didn't go from zero to spying for us. They went over a period of time. They established a pattern of behavior over years and decades of being able to have covert conversations with us that would look like they're not to everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm kind of being a little coy there, but in these cases, I think if he was actually doing a good job, he would have been thinking longer term of establishing patterns of behavior. I mean, think of, we're just talking about the Huerman case. Huerman established a pattern of behavior slowly escalating over a huge period of time, all these other serial killers, but he's brand new, fresh, and he was thinking so compartmentalized right in here. That was thankfully for us and the investigators a flaw.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.